I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. In this fourth week of a summer series on philosophy, the key word is love, which sounds like a bad fit with the neat abstractions we associate with the philosophical enterprise. Categories like logic, justice, the orderly state, the clarification of morals and ethics, the whole realm of metaphysics, meaning the world beyond the physical. Love is sweaty and illogical, disorderly and unjust. None of the rules apply. All's fair in love and war, we've always said. Yet, at the dawn of our recorded culture, love was what the best men of Athens wanted to sort out in endless conversation. And Plato's Symposium recounted the all-night arguments about love among Socrates and his circle is, of all Plato's books, still the easiest, best, most brilliant read for moderns. The observations in it go deep, that people, for example, will do more for love than they would ever do for money or power, and that the lover with the power of the god Eros transforming him is more nearly divine than the beloved. At the core of the book, The Symposium, are two unforgettable images of the divided self cut in two from original nature so that only love can reunite and heal us. And then there's the image of Socrates himself, who seems to have risen above erotic love to something much more peaceful and permanent. Can we call this philosophy, Connection listeners? And do we clarify the love stuff by thinking about it? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Martha Nussbaum joins us again from the studio in Chicago. She's professor of philosophy, classics, and the law at the University of Chicago. First question, Connection listeners, is love still a philosophical subject? Is it part of your philosophy? 1-800-423-TALK joins the conversation with Professor Martha Nussbaum. Welcome back, Martha Nussbaum.
Hi, Chris. It's very good to be back.
Good. Start us out with the ancient Greek wisdom on love. In the Symposium and otherwise, Socratic and otherwise, but mainly in that great conversation with Aristophanes and Alcibiades, among others. Hey there. Try it again, Martha Nussbaum.
Can you hear me now, Chris?
I can just barely hear you. Try.
Okay.
Keep talking.
I'm hearing you well. Is this okay?
It's getting better.
Okay. Better? We're turning it up more and more. They've just switched me, you see, from the phone line to the mic. So, can you hear me now?
I can just barely stand by. Let's get a correction on the phone line. Where are we? Should we start again?
Yeah. Hello?
You hear me, Martha Nussbaum?
Yeah, I hear you.
I can just barely hear you, and I don't know quite what to do about it.
Yeah.
Why don't we start again?
Do you need to try the phone?
Let me read a little moment out of the Symposium and see if the folks in the control room can get a new line to your studio.
Okay.
We start, the starting point in all these discussions of love in classical times is the Socratic dialogue, which Plato called the Symposium. 6 or 8 or 10 men, friends of Socrates, are invited to join in the conversation, kind of in tribute to the god Eros, who was described as among the very original gods. He had no parents. He was created whole immediately after chaos and earth. And these folks sit around thinking about what great things they can say about the god, about his beauty, about his indispensability, and the observation of all the things that people do for Eros. Phaedrus, for example, wonderful tribute, talks about the age, the antiquity of Eros. Being eldest, he is cause to us of greatest goods, for I cannot say what good is greater from youth on than a worthy lover, and for a lover, a worthy beloved. For those who intend to live beautifully must be led through the whole of life by what neither kinship, nor honors, nor wealth, nor aught else can instill so beautifully as Eros. And on it goes. Pausanias observes that people will do all kinds of things for love. For if anyone wishing to get money to obtain office or some other position of power from someone were willing to do the sorts of things that lovers do for their beloveds, making supplications and prayers in their entreaties, swearing oaths, sleeping on doorsteps, willing to do slavish acts of a sort not even a slave would do, he would be prevented from acting this way both by his friends and his enemies, these rebuking him for his flattery and servility, those admonishing him and ashamed for them. Yet people are charmed by the lover who does all this, and the law allows it without reproach. He goes on to say that happy the love slave, it's worth it, and love that love justifies itself, love that sets out to confer virtue and intelligence, driven not by money or ambition, directed at a soul, not at a body, fixed on what is constant. That sort of love is unassailable, even when it turns out to be mistaken. That's the drift of the conversation about love in the symposium, when Socrates and then Alcibiades take it up several notches. We're talking about love. Love in the philosophical systems of the Western world, starting with Plato and Socrates in their circle, with Martha Nussbaum, professor of classics and law and philosophy at the University of Chicago, who's written extensively, not only on the Greeks, but on love in philosophy. Are you there, Martha Nussbaum?
Yeah, I'm there now.
Much better, much better. Yeah.
Okay. I'm on the phone line now. Okay.
Good.
Okay. And I think the symposium is a wonderful work because it shows us that philosophers are not just sitting over there in the academy, detached reflectors about love, but they're really cultural participants. And here we have Socrates in the middle of a group of friends who are giving him all the cultural ideas about love that they've been brought up on and that they can think up for themselves. And then we have Socrates trying to insert a specifically philosophical idea, which is really not just a reflection about love, but it's a proposal to change and transform our loves, to make them more stable, more harmonious, more in keeping with morality.
He writes about an ascent of desire, a kind of escalation, or getting over the storms of love. Can you explain that?
Well, I think what all Greek culture made very clear was that eros is dangerous, that it desires possession of an object, and that's dangerous for both the person who has the desire because he's driven mad, but it's also very dangerous for the person who gets possessed because that person can be destroyed by the possessiveness of the lover. So Socrates wants to keep the tremendous energy of eros and the ability that it has to propel us onward towards the good, towards striving of all kinds, but he wants to find a way of showing that it can be stable and harmonious. And so what he does is to start with an idea which he inserts without really arguing for it, but I think it's really a pretty controversial idea, and that is that the object of erotic love is not the person at all, but it's the person's beauty or fineness. He uses this Greek word kalon, which is really a kind of mixed word both for physical beauty and for beauty of other kinds. So fine is a good English word to describe it. And he says that, look, if you realize that what you love is not the person but the fineness in the person, well then you can look around and you can see that that fineness is in all kinds of people, and so that you can turn your love from the one beautiful body to the many beautiful bodies, and then you'll notice that the soul has a beauty that's even greater than the beauty of the body, so you start embracing in your love all the beautiful souls, but you don't even stop there. Then you notice that systems of law, systems of scientific understanding have beauty, and so you'll turn outwards and embrace with your passionate love all the beauty of the universe, which he eventually compares to a wide sea of the beautiful. And by that time, you don't need a given person anymore. You don't have to depend on the question whether this person returns your love. And so, of course, your love is much more stable. You don't have to run around looking for someone anymore. Aristophanes had described the way that people who are searching for the person that they love run around and they can't do anything else, but they just look for that one person. And so Socrates is saying, you don't have to do that if you love beauty and you love all of it. And then eventually you'll have a marvelous vision where you'll see the transcendent form of the beautiful or the fine, which is immortal and beyond all the particular manifestations of it in the universe. And you'll see that that is much more beautiful than anything in the world at all. And so you'll be entirely satisfied by contemplating that. And
do we believe him?
Well, you see, I think Plato wanted to put it forward as a question and a challenge. He puts in this dialogue on the one side of Socrates, Aristophanes, who says, look, we don't want the half or the whole of anything. We don't want the beautiful, rather. We want our other half. And then Socrates says, we don't want the half or whole of anything. We want the beautiful. And then on the other side of Socrates, he puts Alcibiades, this notoriously beautiful, madly erotic and disorderly person who comes in drunk with violets in his hair and talks about how much he loves Socrates and how he views Socrates as absolutely unique, not like anyone else in the world. So in that way, he reminds us that love is attached to personal uniqueness. So what about that? What happened to that in this remarkable ascent of love? So I think Plato is posing himself and us a problem about love. That is, if we get rid of the personal uniqueness, do we really still have love at all? And, you know, I think he also tries to solve that problem later in his career when he writes this other work primarily about love, the Phaedrus, where now we have a different way of reforming love, which involves much more real personal passion. Now we have a pair of lovers who pursue truth and understanding still, but they pursue it together in the context of a really passionate love of each other, which for the first time involves the idea of erotic reciprocity. I mean, this is very important because the eros of the symposium, and I think in a lot of Greek culture, was imagined as one-sided without reciprocation. But in the Phaedrus, he tries a really complicated thing, which is to combine two different Greek conceptions of love, eros and philia. Now, eros being the strongly passionate sexual one that's focused on possession of an object, and philia being the friendly one, the one that's connected with exchange and reciprocity. And the Phaedrus tries to marry the two of them and say you can have real reciprocity, and not just in conversation, but in desire itself, in a relationship of long standing with the person that you love. And that can be, in a way, stable, because you pursue truth and understanding together and you have a form of life together. It can also involve real respect and reverence for the other person. So you don't want to destroy the person if you see the person as a wonderful person with whom you're pursuing truth and understanding together over the course of a life.
It is less passionate, of course, than eros, but it is an attachment. It is a relationship. Fill in the third of the great trio. I mean, agape, that kind of love beyond attachment, love that Socrates had spoken about in the symposium, really.
Well, agape is a word that's not much used until the Christian writers, and I think it's actually very different from both the symposium and the Phaedrus. That is, in both eros and philia, different though they are, you have the common idea that you've got to pick an object that has merit. So you're looking, even if what you want is reciprocity and friendship, you're looking for an object that has merit. When Aristotle talks about friendship or philia, he says the best kind is where you love the person for their character, and the lesser kinds are where you love them for their pleasantness or some advantage that they give to you, or and so on. But you're always looking for merit. Now, what I think the Christian thinkers brought in is the idea that it's possible to love unconditionally. It's possible to love without demanding merit, the way a parent, they thought, loves a child. The Greeks didn't talk a whole lot about the love of parents for children, I think largely because these male philosophers didn't see a lot of their children if they had them. But the idea that we love come what may, and even if we think that the object has no merit, and even if we think that maybe we have no merit, then there's still a kind of unconditional love of that object. And then that's the kind of love that Christ is thought to have had for human beings, who, of course, don't merit Christ's love.
And God for his creation.
Mm-hmm.
But two questions. It's the same question, but how does this get into philosophy in the in the ancient discipline, and how in the world did it get out of what we call modern philosophy?
Well, I think it got into ancient philosophy not just as a part of the general syllabus, so to speak, but I think as a cultural problem that the philosophers wanted to say they can solve. They can show you how this particularly dangerous and destructive passion can be made part of a life that aims at the good and aims at good citizenship and so on. So they were making an offer to their culture, not just sitting around being detached. I think in some of modern philosophy, the same thing goes on. That is, if you go through the history of this, the pattern of the ascent of love or a ladder of love keeps coming up in the history of Western philosophy, in Augustine, in Dante, even in Spinoza. So at the beginning of modern philosophy with Spinoza, you get a very Platonic approach to the problem of the passions. But then in very recent philosophy, I think it drops out partly because people are just embarrassed to talk about that. Moral philosophy that I grew up on was very spare. It talked really mostly about the use and functions of ethical language, but if it talked about substantive topics at all, they certainly weren't the topics of love and friendship, even when they were writing about the Greeks, where, of course, those were tremendously central topics. But in my day, it would have been regarded as very bad to write a dissertation on that because it was thought to be squishy, soft, not susceptible of tough philosophical analysis, and maybe a little bit embarrassingly personal. But now I think we're getting back to that.
Well, it's interesting. It'd be encouraging to think we are. Who is leading the way back?
I think if you were to go to any meeting of the American Philosophical Association, you would now find papers about love. There's a society called the Society for the Philosophy of Sex and Love. If you kind of even look at the presidential addresses of the American Philosophical Association, my colleague at Northwestern, Richard Kraut, a few years ago gave his presidential address on the topic of love. Gregory Vlastos, one of my teachers, gave his presidential address on a topic that dealt with love in Greek philosophy. So, it's a topic that now is part of the general topics of the field, and I don't know that we've yet produced any very wonderful works on it comparable to Plato's. I think on the whole we do better to talk about Plato or talk about Proust and so on until we can do something as good as
that. Of course, so many other disciplines and writers and people have had their crack at the subject of love, most especially, I suppose, in the 20th century, Freud. Do philosophical reflections and examinations go with those psychological, psychiatric, medical inquiries and disciplines too?
I think that they need to, yeah. I mean, I think more broadly than love, the topic of emotion is a big topic in philosophy. It's a topic that a lot of people are pursuing. But I think they feel the need to look and see what's been going on in cognitive psychology, in psychoanalysis, and also in anthropology, to study the different cultural manifestations of love seems to me to be one of the important things that one can do. And that's a reason to study the Greeks, because they're different, and they do configure the world of the passions somewhat differently from the way we do.
I want to go to calls, Martha, but I want to ask you just one more question. And I'm sort of a little drunk on the symposium and on the pleasures of those reflections. What did the Greeks, though, leave out as kind of modern questions about the nature of love that they hadn't resolved? What is to be settled
Times? What the great problem that they kept wrestling with, which I think they didn't fully resolve, is how can you keep what we value about love, its personal quality, its intensity, while still pursuing morality and good citizenship. And they wrestled with that in all kinds of ways, and that's why their works are so rich and so wonderful. But I think what they didn't bring into the equation at all, which we need to bring in, is the childhood history of love. Hmm. Because I think until you understand how the shape of your love is set by intense and often very ambivalent relationships you have with parents or other figures of attachment that you know in your earliest infancy and childhood, then you really can't pose the problem in the best way. I mean, why does love want to possess the object? Well, Proust, you see, I think shows very clearly that the desire for possession comes out of the terror and insecurity of a child at night who wants to be comforted by its mother, and yet its mother sometimes comes and sometimes goes. She has her husband that she goes to, and he's madly jealous of the husband. What he wants is to get his mother to spend the night in his room, and all his passion is directed towards that end. So I think until we bring in that dimension, we can't understand what the problem is that we're trying to solve.
Martha Nussbaum is our guest from the University of Chicago about the love dimension in part four of our summer series on philosophy. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection, or 1-800-423-TALK. George is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome,
Hi,
George.
I was wondering if philosophy's task is to clarify experience and come up with the terms and the vocabulary, what about the gray areas between the altruistic love and sexual love, philia and eros? What can be said about that, especially in our time when, the divorce rate is so high and people have to learn to be friends, or they don't know where the line is being crossed when they move towards eros, etc. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I think actually this is one place where I want to bring in Aristotle. He's not known very much for being a thinker about eros, but he says a few things, and that is one thing he talks about, because he notices that eros usually is transitory, because the typical Greek paradigm is an older man who loves a, let's say, late teenage, beautiful younger man, but it's imagined as lasting a fairly short time, and then the younger man gets too old for it and goes on to playing the more adult role himself. And so, given that it's short-lived, then the question is what becomes of it later. And Aristotle does say that that it can change into a kind of mutuality and friendship, and he thinks that it's actually improved thereby. Now, whether, of course, we could combine the erotic with the friendly, that's Plato's great question, I think, in the Phaedrus. But Aristotle says, even after you lose the erotic, you could still convert it into a friendship. And that would be a nice thing to think, anyway.
And just how do you convert it? How do you stabilize it?
Well, I think Aristotle's hope is that in the process of loving someone erotically, you get to know their character, and you get to respect that and admire it, and that can be a basis for forming a different kind of relationship as time goes on.
Yes, Martha, is altruism to be preferred over eros?
Well, see, I think altruism can even be a part of eros. If you think about the Phaedrus, what the lovers do out of their wonder and mad passion for each other is they want to promote one another's good. They want to advance the well-being of one another. And so that kind of generosity is, I think, a part of the erotic. And so it doesn't have to always be possessive. It's always difficult to purify it of the possessive. But then if you, in addition, think of the person as also a friend with whom you share activities, with whom you share a conception of a good life, well, then all the more you can have that kind of reciprocity and generosity.
1-800-423-8255 makes the love connection in the fourth of our philosophical hours on the connection. 1-800-423-8255. Patrick is on the line.
Good morning.
Morning, Patrick.
Chris, I hope that you're going to have this philosophical inquiry or session all year long, and not just for the summer.
Maybe forever, Patrick.
Forever. But my question to Martha, and again, congratulations for being one of the prominent philosophers in this country, given the fact that I think there's a tendency that Americans don't really like to talk about philosophy too much because they tend to be so practical all the time. How do you transcend a love in which you find that there's this pure connection among human beings, but yet there's interference in the sections such as class, caste, or even race. Especially in a country like the U.S. where you have multi-ethnics and people are intermingling and you have connections all the time, but yet there is interference with love because of caste, class, and culture. How can you transcend those things through love? And
it's an interesting question. I mean, love is hard enough by itself, and there's so many added obstacles.
It's a very tough question, but I think, the Greeks didn't really face this question, but I think they give us some material for it. That is, they think that, look, what's really important to love is something about the person's soul, what it is they're striving for, what it is they admire. That's what excites you. And that can reveal itself in the features of the body. But it isn't just an inert body you love. You love a live body and enlivened by ideas, hopes, strivings. And so all of that can certainly cross culture. I think that people do all the time love each other across religion and culture, and then they encounter obstacles from other people, which may then put pressure on them, but that love can leap across.
Did Athenian love cross class lines?
Well, it did and it didn't. I mean, I think that people certainly, there were relationships that could be called relationships of love with courtesans, like Pericles' famous mistress Aspasia was a courtesan, and I think probably he really loved her. He certainly
hold that thought. We're going to take a very short break, Martha Nussbaum. We're talking about love in the fourth week of our philosophy series. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. From Boston University. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Love Connection in week four of our series on philosophy. Professor Martha Nussbaum joins us from the University of Chicago. She's a classicist and philosopher who also teaches law. The phone is 1-800-423-8255, and the question roughly is, what's love got to do with it, or what do we talk about when we talk about love? Philosophically speaking, we've been talking about Plato and his circle. You observed, Martha Nussbaum, that for most of the moderns, I mean, Kant, Nietzsche, all the Wittgenstein, too, I suppose, they're all a little squeamish about placing love so centrally in their philosophical systems. In the meantime, every kind of writer, Shakespeare, Dante, Henry James, Proust, the Romantics, have added immeasurably to the literature of love. I wonder, from a philosophical standpoint, what have they added to our understanding of love?
Well, I think you have to turn to literature, especially in the modern period, but even in the ancient period, to understand love, because the details of the experience, the trajectory of the passion, and in the modern period, its history in childhood are all so important to it. So if you think about what is it that you get through Proust that you couldn't possibly get through a philosophical text that didn't have a narrative form, well, you get the sense of how the past shadows the present, how you may think that you're falling in love with Albertine, but really the shadow of your mother is always there, and it's going to make you not see certain things about the real woman, and it's going to complicate the way you love the real woman. So all of that whole dimension had been left out of philosophy until that time. Now, I think philosophers can talk about it, but they can't show it in the way that a literary work can.
What does Shakespeare add? What does Dante add?
Oh, boy. Well, of course, Dante is directly in this Platonic tradition of the ascent of love, and he alludes to it all the time. What he adds, I mean, he makes the surprising claim that you really can't love an individual until you get to Christian love. When Beatrice appears in her chariot and she calls him by his name Dante, that's the first time that the proper name Dante has been used in the poem, and the only time. And then she says of herself, I really am Beatrice. And so what she's trying to emphasize is that the particularity of love is present now at the time when Christian love has entered the poem, and it wasn't present before when Virgil was his guide. Now, why not? I think the point is the one I made before about merit. The point is that you have to be prepared to love the whole person, flaws, faults, and all. And ancient love was too fixed on merit, is his claim, and it's got to get out of that. It's got to be willing to love the whole person. So that was the claim. Now, of course, Dante also, in many ways, leaves out some of the person. Namely, he leaves out the body, pretty much, because it's only when Dante has been already purified of lust in the flames of chastity that he can actually meet Beatrice. So the implication is that the sexual aspect of love has to go before you can see the particular person. I think Dante sees sex as something that obscures from us the particularity of the other, because it's a bunch of egoistic aims and ambitions. And that's not a silly view. I think one has to take that very seriously. But I don't think that's the whole story of sexual love. I think sexual love can reveal the particularity, but Dante didn't. Mm. Shakespeare, well, I mean, Shakespeare is so multifaceted, but I think he... he shows the vicissitudes in the sonnets, especially the tremendous variety and the vicissitudes of love. It's jealousy, it's bitterness, and yet it's wonder. So it's for a very precise mapping of all the moments and parts of love, I don't think there's anything that's more wonderful.
I don't think there's anything more wonderful than you on this subject, Martha Nussbaum. I'm so glad we're doing this and doing it with you. Seriously, 1-800-423-8255 makes, in week four of our philosophy series, The Love Connection. 1-800-423-TALK. Kristen is on the line.
Christopher?
Welcome.
Hi. I'm a little tongue-tied and self-conscious.
Aren't we all?
But you drive me wild when you do these programs. I studied ancient Greek in college and in graduate school and loved Plato. I just get such a kick out of reading him. And I just wanted to make a comment about the format of the dialogue and how important that is in the concept of love. And maybe it's something that's missing in a lot of popular love today and really enrich relationships. It's the whole concept of dialogue, the dialogue within Plato's works, and then, between the people reading it and then carrying that into your own life. So I guess that's what I would say.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right that the dialogue form is one way that he can work in some of the material that I said only literature can give us. That is the connection of love with the whole personality, a form of life, a history. And there's growing interest in reviving the dialogue form. A group of people in Oxford had a little international competition to revive the dialogue form, and they performed all the ones that they chose in Stockholm, because it was the European city of culture. Well, anyway, so there's a bunch of people out there writing philosophical dialogues, and some of them are very, very, very interesting. And
Iris Murdoch did it, in effect, didn't she?
Oh, she did. She did this book, Acastos, that was a whole selection of dialogues, and I actually saw them performed. I have to say that I think she did it more and better in her novels than in those dialogues. I think when she wrote the dialogues...
Well, that's what I was thinking of, actually. I mean, novels as a kind of philosophical dialogue with real characters...
In the novel like The Black Prince, I think that's a novel that's very close to the Phaedrus and really thinks about the same themes. I mean, can a lover be generous? Can the lover really do good for the beloved? That's a wonderful novel, because you get the many layers of imagination and possible self-deception all in there, the battle between egoism and generosity. Mm-hmm. Oh, I think she did wonderful things. And The Sacred and Profane Love Machine is another one that I'm very fond of. All about the egoism of some kinds of love, and then the question whether we can transcend that and really see the other person.
1-800-423-8255 makes the love connection in our philosophy series. Paul is calling from Wellfleet, Massachusetts on Cape Cod.
Good morning, Professor Nussbaum.
Good morning.
I'm actually a former student of yours from Brown University back in 1980-something, 5-6, I guess. Philosophy and the novel.
Oh, great.
I was wondering if you had seen a terrific new Tom Stoppard play. It's actually it's called The Invention of Love.
No, I haven't seen that yet. I've heard about it, but I haven't seen it. So tell me, what does it give us?
Well, it's really brilliant. It's about A.E. Housman, the British poet and professor, and his own and also classics scholar, and his own closeted homosexuality at the time in tension with the Greeks' openness about homosexuality, and how while he is valued as a scholar of the period, his own homosexuality was very deeply hidden within him. And anyway, it's just a terrific discussion of.
I'll have to look for that. You know, that's also the theme of Forster's novel Morris, where we get the two young men sitting in their tutorial at Cambridge or Oxford, and suddenly they get to the part in the Phaedrus where the men fall in love with each other, and the tutor says, omit a reference to the unspeakable vice of the Greeks. And so they just don't translate that part. They leap over it. And that was the way that a lot of classical scholarship was in those days. And, of course, Forster saw in that a metaphor for his own closeted homosexuality. And Morris was a wish fulfillment fantasy, in a way, a fantasy of what it would be like to be able to be honest. And of course, Morris ends up moving out of England in order to live the life that he wants.
Is the Phaedrus also the basis in some fashion of Thomas Mann's Death in Venice?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. And the vision of the beautiful boy, that's taken pretty much straight out of the Phaedrus, and there's direct allusion to the Phaedrus, and the way that vision of beauty just transforms the whole personality and produces a shuddering and a trembling. All of that is very much out of the Phaedrus.
1-800-423-8255, the love connection in our philosophy series. Roger is on the line.
Jeez, thanks very much for taking my call. I listen to the show much more than I should, and I always wonder, geez, what are all these people
doing? It's
good
for you,
Roger. But in any case, there's a French philosopher named Denis de Rougemont who I don't think is read or known very much anymore, but I read a book of his while in college that had a deep effect on me. And he, as I recall, he put forth the thesis that the rise of courtly love in the 11th and 12th and maybe 13th centuries introduced this element of unrequited love and the deification of the other, which he pointed to sort of survived and thrived in our culture in the literature of say pop songs, You're My Angel, or You're Like Heaven to Me, or Let's Go to Heaven. He introduced this, I think, as a corrosive element in human relations, and I'm just very curious about your comments on his thesis, if you're familiar with it, and if it rings true to you.
Yeah, well, I think it's actually a lot older than that. You get this in the Greek, the deification of the object is already in the Greeks and Romans, and in fact, in Lucretius, he makes fun of it, and he says that if you want to get yourself out of that kind of love, which he thinks of as self-deceived and bad, then what you have to do is to try to substitute for every adjective that you'd use for your mistress deifying her some other more mundane adjective that shows you what she really is. Instead of calling her a Ceres nursing Bacchus, you'll just say she's fat or something. So he gives you a series of deflations of that myth of the deified woman, and culminating with the idea that you go to her home sometime when she's not expecting you, and a terrible smell comes out, and then you see that she's just a bodily creature. Now, scholars have wondered for ages and written learned treatises about what the terrible smell is. Is it flatulence? Is it her menstrual period? Is it some chemical she's using to put on her makeup? But anyway, the idea is that once you realize she's just a body, then you'll fall out of love. Now, that does show you, I think, what's bad about that over-idealization. And I think this is what de Rougemont is onto in the medieval courtly love, which carries it even further. Namely, if you think that what you've got is an otherworldly being or a goddess, then you're set up for a tremendous disappointment when you realize, as inevitably you do, that what you've got is a human being. And so in the end, what Lucretius recommends, he says very cryptically, you have to learn to yield to human life. And what does that mean? Well, I think it means learning to love a real body, a real human being. And that's what's always so difficult to do.
1-800-423-TALK, the love connection. Penelope is on the line.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my question. I'm very interested to know how and if the philosophers have handled this ultimate question or the acid test of love, i.e. if true love lasts forever.
Well, you know, and that is already asked in the symposium. And the question that Socrates is posing is, do you want just to possess the beautiful for a while, or do you want to possess it forever? Now, he says that really, people who possess the object of their desire are still filled with longing because they know that they haven't yet possessed it forever, because they also know that they're not going to be around forever. So he introduces an idea, which I think is a very important idea, of the impulse to creation in love that's connected with the perception that you yourself are going to die. Now, how would you make a love immortal? Well, you can't do it by loving the person immortally, because you're both going to die. So you think about what you will create. Now, he says some people will create children, and Plato has a pretty low opinion of those people. He thinks that's a pretty boring kind of creation. But he does think that people who are more spiritual will create things of the spirit. They will create works of art, works of literature, works of science, whatever, something in which their love lives on. And so he thinks of love as a creation in the beautiful, where the beauty of the person you love serves as a kind of vehicle for a spiritual pregnancy that will bring forth something that lives after you. Well, I think that's a very important idea, and it's something that, you know, taking out the fine highfalutin language, we probably all try to do that when we love people. We think
what's a good example, Martha Nussbaum, of a love that lasts?
Well, I think, you know, think about Shakespeare recording the moments of his passion in a poem. Now, I mean, I think that's an example of what Plato has in mind. Now, we don't all do it that way. And I think, of course, Plato had much too low an opinion of having children. And I think many, many people record their love by having and loving and raising children. And that's a very good way to transmit the things you care about and the things that bind you together to a further generation, which will then transmit it yet further. Or, you know, by doing something for your country is another thing. I mean, you love somebody partly because you share a passion for justice or whatever, and then you try to make that eternal by doing something for your country, however small it might be. But in other words, whatever it is that brings the people together, and that whatever it is they share, they can also take further and do something that makes the world better. I think that's Plato's idea, and it may sound too high-minded. I don't think we should always be focused on that, or we wouldn't have any fun. But, you know, it's one thing that I do think about a lot, and I think it is important.
1-800-423-8255 speaks of love on the connection in the philosophy series. Derek is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Derek.
Hi. I love your show. I listen to it all the time.
Thank you.
I studied philosophy as an undergraduate at UMass, and what I see happening with Plato, and unfortunately continuing on through the medieval Christian and later Christian tradition, is a sort of overemphasis of the mind-body duality, or dichotomy, and where, you know, the concerns of the body and the, you know, things like desire and sexual desire and longing are sort of downplayed or even made to sound base. And I think what we have over our predecessors, when we talk about love nowadays, I think we've sort of come to grips with the fact that love is always going to be tied up with suffering somehow, because it's always going to be tied up with this kind of longing. And I think that, in fact, instead of debasing the experience, I think it enriches it. And I think the romantic authors and some more popular writers and even musicians of the last 100 years or so have made it possible for us to come to grips with that.
I think that's a very, very well-spoken resolution of what, and definitely in Catholicism, but even more in Plato, is seen as a terrible tension between the spirit and the flesh.
But I think, you know, it isn't clear to me that the Romantics always embrace the bodily aspect of love. I mean, if you think about Wuthering Heights, what they're trying to do is to become pure spirits, in effect. And it's very interesting that Kathy really can't have a healthy child. I mean, she just doesn't, she really isn't in this world physically, insofar as she's a passionate romantic being. They're kind of like flames that are burning with passion and burning each other up. So I think there is a romantic conception of love focused on striving that really repudiates the body just as much as Plato does in its own way. And look, the body is comic, and you really, if you really are going to embrace the body, you have to embrace its accidents, its dailiness, all the things that Lucretius talks about, the smells, the fact that somebody might not be your ideal image, and so on. So
just from your own vast reading, Martha Nussbaum, I mean, who gets that right, philosophically speaking, the resolving the tension of flesh and spirit?
Oh, it's, you know, I've been working for many years on a book on the emotions, and I end it with a long section on the ascent of love, and I always had this question of where do I end up? What do I
How far up the ladder do you want to live, right?
Yeah, and actually, you know, my last chapter, and I don't think it's like the whole of the book, right, but my last chapter is about Joyce's Ulysses, because I think there's something in Joyce that I find very, very tender and very deep, that is really a love of the body and all its accidents, a desire to put on the page for your embrace all the things of the body, Leopold Bloom sitting in the outhouse, all the way to Molly with her menstrual period, ruminating about her body and his body, but also genuinely loving and remembering love. And I think the final yes of that long speech with which the novel ends, you know, that is an embrace of the flesh with all of its accidents and surprises. So I find that very moving.
Stand by for one more call. Russ is on the line from Burlington, Vermont.
Yes, Chris, I'm not sure what type of love it is I have for your show, but I assure you it's very deep and enduring.
Thank you, Russ. You're welcome.
For Martha is, what does philosophy have to say about what seems to be the inherent tension between love and truth as we are living our lives? And I guess the best example, or one of the good examples, could be someone that you love has a brain tumor and they don't know it, and you want, out of love, you want to shield them from it, and yet you understand that truth is has a power all to itself, and should you tell them, should you not? That's one example, and I wonder if philosophy talks about others.
Yeah, well, of course, Plato's whole idea is that the love is all about the love of truth, and they're pursuing the love of truth together. But as to these daily questions of what you say and what you tell, I think that isn't part of what the ancient philosophers talked about. They're all worried about how you're going to see the other truly, how you're going to see truth with the person, whether you're going to deceive yourself about the person. But this other question you pose is very fundamental, I think. And you see discussion of it today in a lot of medical ethics, and it is the fundamental issue of medical ethics. But as a question of love, I haven't seen it raised very much, and I think, of course, it is. It's got to be raised. What is the relation, you might say, between love and respect? Because respect suggests that we give that person the truth, and love might suggest that we shield them from that truth if we think it's going to harm them, and it's extremely difficult.
Let's leave it on that very provocative note. I also loved your sort of suggestion of Joyce's Ulysses is a place where all of these things from the ancient tradition and the modern tradition and the Christian tradition get somehow bound up. Martha Nussbaum, this is Habit Forming, and would love to do it again.
Well, me too.
Professor Martha Nussbaum at the University of Chicago, thank you, and Listeners, especially, thank you for plunging in. You can continue the love conversation on our website at theconnection.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. We gotta let love roll. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian Oriental Rugs, featuring over 6,000 rugs from around the world. Gregorian, little part of Persia in Newton Lower Falls. By Upstairs at the Pudding, hosting the first in a series on wine dinners on Wednesday, July.